Good evening, everyone. I'm Bernard Schwartz, director of the 92nd Street Y's Unterberg Poetry Center, and it's my privilege to welcome you to the second and final collaboration we have in this year's Penn World Voices Festival, a conversation between Shirley Hazard and Richard Ford. Tonight's program, which will feature both conversation and readings of Ms. Hazard's work by Annabelle Davis Goff, will last about an hour and 15 minutes. Afterward, Ms. Hazard has kindly agreed to sign books. However, unlike most of our signings, this one is going to take place up here on stage. Upon the conclusion of the event, we ask that everyone exit the hall, and for those of you interested in having your books signed, a line will be forming through the lobby. It'll take just a few minutes to get the stage ready for the signing, and then we'll move the line back into the concert hall. Before we begin, our friends at Penn have asked me to say a few words about the empty chair situated to the left of the podium. As many of you may well know from having attended other events at this year's festival, the chair stands as a symbol of those artists from around the world who have been robbed of their right to freedom of expression, artists who are prevented from practicing their craft openly or without fear of persecution, artists who are unable to join us this week. For more specific information on Penn's human rights efforts, please visit their website at penn.org or their table out in the lobby. As Shirley Hazard herself once wrote, "For most people, it's easier to support an eminent person in deserved disgrace than an obscure one who has been wronged. But the only proper solidarity is with the truth, if one can discover it." And now please welcome Richard Ford and Shirley Hazard.
I'm sorry, I've got a game leg. It's going away soon, but not soon enough to help tonight. But I'm so glad to see you. Thank you for coming.
And I thank you for coming, too. It's a rare occasion that you would do this for us tonight and with us tonight. And just to sort of begin the evening, so that we're not just talking about literary gossip the whole night, I'm going to ask your great friend, Annabelle Davis Goff, to come on stage and read a passage from the right at the beginning, I think, of the first story you ever published in The New Yorker.
First I ever wrote.
Yes, well, yes. Worse yet. Here's Annabelle Davis Goff.
This is from Harold. Every evening of the summer, lanterns were hung from the oleanders, and they had dinner in the garden. The table was a long and rickety affair on trestles, and there were always insects because of the lights, but on balance, it was worth it. The evenings were cool, even after the August days, which recorded heat long after dark in the villa's outer walls. The wall facing onto this terrace garden was still warm to the touch, although it was past 9 o'clock, and Signora Riccardi and her guests were sitting down to dinner. The scene, too, was worth the discomfort. The white table, 3 flasks of wine, pale dishes of bread, red dishes of meat, green bowls of salad, the summer-colored dresses of the women and a crimson shawl hung on a chair. Everything scented by flower beds in eclipse beyond the lanterns and by lemon trees which stood about in great stone urns. Above the line of the hills facing across a valley, the sky glowed from the lights of Siena. But the house at night rode its hilltop in rolling, dark countryside with the purposeful isolation of a ship at sea. And people around the table, too, assumed something of the serene animation of voyagers.
When I hear her read that story, and I read that story again yesterday, I think to myself, how could a girl 20 years old write that story. I know Mr. Maxwell at the New Yorker said that they were just dazzled, that it was the first story you'd ever written, the first story that you'd ever sent any place. Can you tell us something about the origins of that story and also what it was like to be living in New York, working at the UN, and suddenly decide what you wanted to do was write stories?
Yes, I don't know that it was as sudden as all that, because although it was the first story I wrote, and of course it was wonderful to me that it was accepted with a lovely letter from a wonderful man who's now dead, William Maxwell, who was a fine writer, and he spent several days a week at the New Yorker, where he was an editor. And he and his lovely wife, they became great friends to me. And the generosity of these people, the time they gave up to the new writers who were brought in, and the kindness one had, and never a cross word which would which would have been perhaps something they felt they could well utter, but they nobody was other than wonderfully encouraging and kind to me. And I had been working several years at the United Nations, and while I had friends there, it wasn't an encouraging place, and for a young woman like me, there really was no advancement at all. And nobody even, I think, thought that there should be any advancement. The idea was, well, you're here, you're fairly young and not brutally ugly, and you'll probably get married, and so we're not going to do anything for you. That was the world that should do something. And so, really, I began to think I should do something for myself.
Wow.
And I always, people often had said to me that did I never think of being a writer? Well, I might have thought of it, but that's rather different from becoming a writer. And I felt many people who can express themselves fairly well and can write a nice memorandum, they perhaps think they can have a literary career. And that was very off-putting to me. I thought, well, perhaps I'm just like that and will never really have a literary career. And then I thought, why not? I had a story and I sent it, because the best place to send it really was the New Yorker, and I didn't see why I should send it anywhere else. I expected it.
it makes perfect sense.
I expected it to be rejected, but I thought, well, I could be rejected by the best place, you know. So they didn't reject it.
When Mr. Maxwell was your editor at the New Yorker, and he was your editor for a long time,
yes,
I think.
Yes, and a great friend, too.
Was he, and he was, of course, the editor of Eudora Welty and many, many other wonderful story writers, John Cheever. Was he an active editor for you?
This was a very important thing for me, because no matter how pleased I was with everything that was happening, I didn't want changes. No. I don't mean I didn't want a comma change, and they were quite great on changing commas, but I didn't suffer anything like that. And also I was always consulted about, would this be a better word, or you use the same word in the last paragraph, these things. And it was all done with such kindness, really, courtesy and kindness, and as if there were real interest in having the story and getting it published. It was really a wonderful time for me.
I don't think I've ever seen you use the same word twice in an entire book.
Well, maybe is and but.
That's right. I want to ask you something about being funny, because the story Harold, which Annabelle just read a part of, is a very funny story in places. There's a line of Henry James that I always think about. It says that there are no themes so human as those that show the connection between bliss and bale, between the things that help and the things that hurt.
Between
the things that help and the things that hurt.
Yes.
And it makes me wonder if when you are funny on the page, I mean, I think you're natively funny, but when you're funny on the page, are you always in pursuit of something poignant? Are you always in pursuit of something more serious?
I'm glad you say that, because I think that life is like the page in that sense, that sometimes it is funny,
yes,
or amusing, and I like that because I myself like life that has some amusement in it. But in the ultimate sense, it's not funny, and it's nice that we have the alleviation of being amused by things.
Indeed.
And I've always had wonderful friends who could be very amusing, even if they were sardonic. They could do this in a properly sardonic, smiling way.
Most writers that I know think that their work is very funny, and nobody else thinks that their work is very funny. They're the ones who think it is. But humor is actually larded through, well, not as much, I guess, in The Great Fire, but certainly in The Transit of Venus. The Transit of Venus is an extremely, extremely funny book, although not mirthful, one would not say.
Well, ultimately, one has to be serious. It's like life. But on the way, if you can see a bit of the wit that is in life itself and the way one has to subject oneself to that, and even so find something, find some irony, some self-amusement within this, mm-hmm, it's a better way to live than being disgruntled all the time.
Indeed. While we're on the subject of your young life, I believe that you went to work for the British Special Operations Branch when you were 16 years old.
Yeah, 16, yes.
How exactly does one go to work for the Special Operations Branch when you are 16 years old and living where, in Hong Kong?
I was in Hong Kong, yes. I worked in an office where it was an intelligence office, and the British officers who were in charge there, they had been in the war, all of them, some of them very young, others not, and they wanted in that office, where this was, of course, in China, and in Hong Kong, rather, which was a British colony then, but they needed somebody in the office, even if it was a creature typing or like me, they needed a person who would have a British background. There were certain things that were that couldn't just be cast out on the waters all the time. And so I came in handy then. And then I found they came in handy a bit too. I had nice times. And I look back, or even at the time, I was aware that that it was something quite marvelous. Although at the time I thought all life was going to be like that, with such amusing people who had experience and yet didn't make a point of it. And life didn't turn out entirely, entirely like that. But still, I knew it could be like that. And that's something that you don't have to keep saying, but this can't be the life I thought I would have. No, I knew that this is a good way to be.
Since the sort of peregrinations of your life sort of made it impossible to go to university, you've written some about what an education it was to be around those Foreign Service officers, how literate they all were, and how verbal they were about their literacy.
It was wonderful, and they were wonderful people, and I kept always in touch with certain of them, very close friends, and we kept in touch. They were older than I, and now they start to disappear. Oh, yeah. And I feel that I don't have that marvelous link in my life where people from far off, when I was very young, were still very a vital part of my life. Even if we were separated by half the world, we would always meet up again. Mm-hmm. And then when I met and married my husband, he also was very fond of these people. We didn't have to make any choice, his and hers friends or anything. He also loved them.
Now I want to switch subjects here just a little bit. A feature of your prose, as anyone who reads it, as I have rather religiously over the years, would realize that you have the capacity to be epigrammatic.
I have the capacity to
be epigrammatic. You write sentences which actually stick in one's brain.
I'm so glad.
And well, you wrote one time, maybe it was in this wonderful interview that you did with Sandy McClatchy for the Paris Review. You stressed in your work the importance of what you called original observation. And I wonder now, if is it your wish as you write along writing sentences to write sentences which can leap off the page in a reader's into a reader's brain? I mean, I'm constantly stopped, and because something has stopped me because it is so, in fact, memorable.
That's very nice of you.
Well, it's also true.
That's what ideally one should have, things that leap a bit off the page. If they're just doggedly sitting on the page waiting to be encouraged, I don't think this is a good way of writing. Yes.
Right. On the subject of poetry, you said that, and have said that, poetry saved your life.
It's been the longest important thing in my life.
Yes. How does poetry save one's life?
I don't know. I can't tell you that, except that somehow the ear is accessible in certain people to this. And I very, very early on, of course, mothers exaggerate, but my mother said when I was 18 months old, you don't have to believe this, that I recited, somebody had recited to me, some grown-up person recited to me, "This is the house that Jack built," and I said it back to them. Now, as I say, a mother is a very indulgent, a very indulgent person, but I even have a vague recollection of very early having a loving feeling for poetry. Good poetry. I knew very well what was good poetry and what was bad.
I know it's horrible to have things that you say be held up to you again after you've said them as though you really meant them. But you said once, that you didn't know how people could live without poetry. And when I grew up, there was not poetry. And it made me wonder, how do you think people who don't have poetry actually do live?
Well, I think about this too. It can't be forced on people. Now you've got to listen to poetry grabbing them by the lapels or something. But it's also, poetry comes in different forms. It can come in mere feeling. I think people realize within themselves that they have deeper feelings than language always allows them to express. And poetry can save very much the souls of people who feel that way, who feel cut off from a deeper thing in themselves and are having to fit in with much more daily forms of expression.
I think I'd like just for a moment to ask Annabel Davis Goff, the novelist, to come out and read another passage. This from your novel from 1970, The Bay of Noon.
Bay of Noon has been nominated for the last Booker Prize, which he's been given this summer in London. So here you are, said Gioconda, as if she'd been waiting my arrival for a long time, or as if, entering into my own point of view, she could regard my presence in her room as the fulfillment of an intention, even though not her own. It was curious to think then how I had for weeks been aware of her while she had not known of my existence. "Your street," I said to her, "your street is marvelous." "Oh, this street." She thought so too, so much so that good manners called for her to deprecate it. "They're always telling me, my friends, why don't you move? Because it's rough round here, you know, a kind of important squalor." "Not squalor, exactly." "Not squalor," she cried. "If this street isn't squalid, I'd like to know what is." We both laughed at her indignation, she putting a hand up to her mouth in a gesture so completely hers that picturing it brings her more before my eyes than any photograph could do. It was as if she were quite irrationally self-conscious about her mouth or her teeth, or unavailingly wished to be moderate in her responses. This is Naples with a vengeance, and literally so, since we have the vendetta around here. I'm always hearing the grocer was stabbed, or that they're on the lookout for the dry cleaner. But there it is, it's what I'm used to. I couldn't live elsewhere. Saying this, her expression clouded, as if being bound to that place was a disturbing rather than a stabilizing attachment. I was born here. She turned to me and asked, again as if we were children exchanging information, where were you born? It isn't so much where one was born, as a matter of fact, in my case, it was in Notting Hill Gate, but what one remembers. I told Jocondo how, as a child, I'd been sent with other children on a ship to Cape Town to escape the Blitz. How my mother died at the end of the war, and my brother came out to Africa to work in Somaliland, and I moved there with him and at last went back to London. London's nice, she said. I was there not so long ago. We'll talk about it another day when there's more time. The assumption of our friendship moved me in my loneliness with a sort of joy that this lovely, vital creature was to attach her life, however lightly, to mine. I was touched, but showed no pleasure, just as when I stood in the Piazza del Gesù and walked under the windows of San Biagio dei Libri. In fact, I was often, later on, to act out with Gioconda, a circumspection I did not feel. Her abundance made others reticent. Her openness evoked discretion. I'm called Jenny, I told her, in answer to her question, for we were pursuing our childlike exchange, as if we might at any moment have come out with, how old are you, or what does your father do? It's not your name, then? Jenny is a bureaucratic accident. My name is Penelope. When I was put on board the ship for South Africa at the beginning of the war, I was called Penny, but there were so many of us, so many little Mollies and Timmies and Patties, that the woman in charge of us got the names mixed up. Jenny was as close as she ever came to mine. I was not of an age to make an issue of it. I went on board as Penny and disembarked as Jenny. Gioconda said nothing, imagining I knew the journey. Whenever the matter came up, people expressed anguish over that uprooting of mine. Yet, although the sufferings of children are the worst, being inextinguishable, children themselves seldom have a proper sense of their own tragedy, discounting and keeping hidden the true horrors of their short lives, humbly imagining real calamity to be some prestigious drama of the grown-up world. Other unconfided things were worse to me at the time than the actual fact of my removal to South Africa. For that searing displacement, at least, bore official sanction in the minds of adults and was shared with hundreds of others. The loss of my name, and for such a reason, did not offend me until much later. Indeed, for even a child can wish for the illusion of a new identity, arriving in a strange country, purge of the past, starting afresh. In fact, a child is more entitled to the delusion. I fancied, as I landed at Cape Town, that the voyage enabled me to begin what, with no sense of comedy, I identified to myself as a new life. A double life, rather, for in my letters and my homesickness, I remained Penny. As a little girl, however, I saw myself as such, insignificant in the convulsions of war, and believed I had no cause for complaint in a world where soldiers died and cities were devastated. It is only in retrospect I know myself to have been among the victims of war, and dare not mention that at the time I suffered more grotesquely over exclusion from a school party or from the fear of punishment in connection with a torn blazer. That stranded childhood comes back to me in curious ways with unlikely associations. the sea, for instance. In those years of war, children were greatly aware of the sea and of those imperiled on it. It was the ocean, its impassibility, that lay between me and the natural course of my life, between me and home. The ships of my childhood figured like heroes in their disasters. The city of Benares, the Jarvis Bay, the San Demetrio, the Ark Royal, the Graf's Bay. We used to see ships, shabby, painted gray, put in at Cape Town Harbor to disappear in the night and perhaps forever. We knew their shapes and tonnages. We accumulated stories of the Atlantic crossings and the Arctic convoys. We knew that the Queens could outpace any U-boat and carried 8,000 troops, and that you could stay 14 days in a neutral port. By contrast, it seems now that the sea has almost retired from our lives and that ships are leading a marginal twilight existence, like senior officials who resist being pensioned off. Joconda said, "Yet I think you look more like Jenny than Penelope. I could never picture Penelope with that color hair." Sometimes, though, I still feel like Penelope. When I fill out a form, it feels appropriate. I remarked on her own name. It's not uncommon in Italy, or common either. The cat, she said, completing the game of names, was called Giocasta, had been renamed from Innocente after conceiving kittens with its own son. In commendation or sympathy, she snatched it up round the middle with both hands, as a child might, gave it a squeeze and set it down again on its chair, where it smoothly resumed a wash, interrupted in mid-lick. "Come onto the terrace and tell me if it's warm enough to lunch out there." That room of hers gave onto a terrace, long and wide and sheltered at one end by a pergola draped with the wintry skeletons of vines, and by wisteria that still showed, here and there, a purple tassel or a frond of green. At the other end, there were stone boxes of marigolds. A table had been laid for us in the pale sun, and one of its legs was lengthened with a wedge of paper to meet the uneven tiles. "It's heaven," I said.
Last year, when John Updike died, Adam Gopnik wrote in The New Yorker, he said that Updike was a writer who managed to get himself fully expressed in his life. And when I hear a passage like that, and when I read your books, one of the things I'm always thinking is that you are setting for yourself the task of saying absolutely everything important that needs to be said about whatever your mind has
that
fallen on.
That would be ideal.
Ah.
Yes.
So that really is that really is the sum of it then.
Well, it's not that one can be even fully expressed all the time, but once in a while one hopes to write something, even a sentence, where you feel now that was what you wanted to say. And that may not be something that's particularly noticed, but you know that you somehow came to a culmination of how words can be put together. We are so lucky to have the language we have that draws on many languages originally. I mean, it's not a language that has fixed roots. It has Latin in it. It has even Greek. But we are so lucky to have this very flexible language and a marvelous literature of all tastes that goes with it, the literature that really uses our, reaches to our thoughts and our expressions. And I think for writers who are readers, because they're not always readers, but most of them are, but I think it is I would even say an inspiration. We know that something can be very well done and deeply done in all kinds of shades and tones, and it's a challenge to find another shade or tone
It's very rare.
Would add something original. Yes.
It's very rare to find that in a book. It's very rare to find novelists who are willing even to admit that.
I think people feel challenged to be tough now. They may not be particularly tough at home, but they want to be tough on the page. Hmm. And I think there's a kind of bravado about not using unfamiliar words, and mm-hmm. yet we can't let them all die out. What mm. would we be doing, just gasping away there in the end?
Yeah, but you have a wonderful line. You said, I feel that people are more happy, people are more unhappy for not being able to fully express something or to profit from somebody else having expressed it.
Oh, I think this is very true, that people feel they don't have the words to say, well, how terrible, or how beautiful. They're embarrassed to use a word very often like beautiful, and yet it's a beautiful word.
Mm. Let me change another subject here. I've got a million of them. There's a woman who is so responsive, and as a writer who is so responsive to history and to ancient culture. And what do you think about America here, a country so seemingly intent on erasing and ignoring its past and sees the past not as a prologue but as an encumbrance? You've lived here for 60 years.
I didn't hear what the last thing you said was.
I said you've lived here a long time, and your dedication as a writer and as a thinker is so much to the past and to the evidence of the past in the present. And here you live in a country which is so dedicated to erasing its past and has a short one to begin with.
Well, I think that America now has much more past even than when I first came here.
Well, indeed it does. There's little arguing that.
It's a question of, I think Oscar Wilde said a very clever thing about it, and I wish I could remember exactly, but it was about America and its newness, and that it's so new that it doesn't know how to grow old. And it's not entirely true, because I think in America is so vast and has so many characteristics, as it were, playing into it, that there is almost nothing it doesn't have except antiquity. And there are so many different shades of people thinking about their lives and expressing themselves, that it can't just be encapsulated in a single word, America.
Well, you've written about it not very much in your life.
Not much, no, because I tend to write about things that are past, if I'm drawing on my own experience, that is. But I have lived in ancient countries, and I've expressed sometimes feeling about that, which has always been... It's always been a thing, a source of great interest, and sometimes of tragedy in countries, of course, who've all suffered and loved and had great experience. It's always been a pleasant thing for me to be in an old country where people aren't expecting everything to turn new and brassy in a moment. But I think America has changed very much since I first came to live here. It's much more conscious of the great world, and the deeper thought of the great world, really, from suffering, from things that happened historically. But America now becomes a historic place.
And well, we always thought it was. We just didn't have.
Well, I think they have to give
to
up the idea a bit that they're new, because there are so many places that are new. You hardly know how to keep up with them.
I told you when we talked on the phone the other day that I was going to ask you about place, because you and I, as writers, have, it seems to me, very different ways of engaging place. And there's no reason to go into my thinking about my way of engaging place, but I noticed that you sometimes personify place. When you write about Naples, you write about Naples as though Naples had a character, as though it had an essence, which could be identified, which could be profited from. different from a point of view in which places just have the characters which we imbue them with.
Yes.
And so am I correct that you do in fact think of places as having those kinds of almost romantic characters?
I think I write about place mostly places that have an ancient past, which has always been fascinating to me. I was born in a country that did not have an ancient past and wasn't too anxious to think about its recent past because it had been a convict colony, you know, and had that tragedy in it. And now it isn't like that at all. For one thing, they had great migration into Australia from not just from English-speaking countries, not just from Britain. Mm. And yet they had that... They had something that nearly all of us have, the marvelous access to the English language, which applies all over the world. Mm. And it's always a different tone of language in different places, but still, this is a great advantage we have where we can express ourselves in the language that, if we choose, is an ancient and very expressive language, a very varied language, in fact.
But do you think that places have... spirits, that places have spirits, have essences, have characters different from, I mean, which are different from us, which are indigenous to themselves?
Well, I don't know how to express that because it's always changing. A place is always changing. There are new generations, and then the world, we know that the world around us is being capsized and settled up a bit in the meantime. It's a much more varied world than most people in the past had to cope with. And yet we have something in this language that makes it possible for us to have a continuity. I think that is important, that there is some continuity to so many races, people who came here, people who changed America also. And it's not... it's not possible just to encapsulate that in one expression or treat a country as if it's a person. However, there are characteristics that get developed. And America certainly has its own characteristics, but they vary all the time, you know.
My temptation in writing about places is always to make it just be the background in front of which the principles do what they do and just to use it more or less inanimately. After saying I wasn't going to tell you that, I told you that. I suppose I wish, in a way, I had a more romantic vision that was more like your own, because I think it turns out to be an expression of affection.
Yes, it is. I think it is, and it's an expression also of sympathy. I mean, sympathy in the wider sense that you feel. Well, we're all in this together. Whatever we've got into in this world, we're in it one way or another, we're in it together. But there is so much a wider consciousness of the great world now, even than when I was a child. Mm-hmm. It was more dividing into where you were born, what you could make of your life. And it's not like that now. When people travel more, they live in different countries, they take work in different countries. And they marry people who are not from their own town, as it used to be all the time. And I think there's something very exciting about that. But there's also something that makes great demands on people, the lack of continuity, which we value also. We don't want everything just to be the same all the time. But still, there isn't much of a continuity now in our thoughts, I think, of how we will create our own lives. We're a bit dominated by how circumstances feel they ought to create our lives. Prosperity ought to create a life. Well, that's not entirely true.
That makes sense to me. When you hear yourself speak, you were a child in Australia. You were learning languages all of your young life. You've lived in New York for a long time, and you live in Capri some of the years, and you're speaking Italian. And when you hear yourself speak, what do you hear?
What an interesting question. You're trying to say something grammatical, I think, in the first place.
No. And then you are. No, I'm not.
One is.
What is? Oh, okay. I know one.
One is. I think you were pretty grammatical, as a matter of fact. But I think when one speaks oneself, as you get older, you hear yourself more. At first, when you're very young, you're blurting out whatever your feelings are to quite an extent, or you're very quiet because you're afraid of not making a proper impression, or because your parents were always saying hush. You know, you have to. Mm.
Did they say that to you too?
Oh no, they weren't saying hush. They wanted me to shut up quite a lot, but that's different.
Well, I was curious. The Australian accent, so to say, which is not uniform, although to our American ears, an Australian accent sounds sort of uniform. But you've lived all over. It's very hard to imagine you with a broad Australian accent. It's been plowed under and gone over, and being a writer makes you so eminently conscious of all of your utterances, as you say.
I think also being a writer unites you very early in life, a reader especially, to the English language, and you realize there's a better way of expressing yourself. The more you read, the more you listen, and the more you're accessible. But also, both my parents came from the British Isles. They were not English, they were both Celtic. My father was born in Wales, my mother was born in Scotland. And I think that had made an impression on me quite early. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 15 or 16, I went to live in my parents. My father was in the diplomatic service, and we went to live in Hong Kong, which was not yet China then, but of course it was China. And that was simply wonderful. And after a couple of years, my sister got, who was older than, is older than I, she got tuberculosis there, and we had to leave. And I'm still a little bit grieving for that separation, which was a separation from a completely interesting and sympathetic life to me.
Some place you had a character say, it may actually be in The Great Fire, which we're going to hear a bit of in a moment, but you said that sometimes when you leave a place, as you left Australia, you end up feeling nostalgia for a place that you actually never liked, even when you were living there.
That was my mother who was like that. That wasn't me so much.
No. Actually, it was a character in a novel who said it.
Oh, yes.
A novel that you wrote.
Yes, I took that from my mother because I didn't take the sentiment from my mother, but I noticed that in the many places we lived in when I was growing up, she didn't like it at all when she first got there, or even after she got there. And as soon as we left, it was, remember our lovely days in China or wherever it was. And I determined I'm not going to be like that. If I am enjoying it, if I find something interesting, I'm going to try to incorporate it in my life. Of course, it wasn't always interesting. There were some moments of wishing you were not in that particular place. However, I was always curious about it. What will come next if you aren't assimilated into this place, but there'll be another one? And that was, I think this is a great privilege, great advantage that one had, that one wasn't, because a child, a young person, is so often just the captive of their family. If the family's moving from the one side of the earth to the other, the child has to accept that, leave the school, leave its friends, all these things. And so I think I was lucky in that I always had this feeling of seeing interesting and new places.
That willingness to feel nostalgia for a place you never liked to begin with, maybe the true sign of a malcontent.
But I didn't want to fall in that trap.
No, I know you didn't.
Yes, to be nostalgic for something you were complaining about at the time. And I think one has to watch out for that sort of stuff.
This would be a good moment, I think, to ask our friend Annabelle Davis Goff to come and read a passage from The Great Fire.
Thank you. Thank you, Annabelle.
Thank you.
On his first mornings in Hong Kong, Exley set out early. The short walk to his office led past the cricket ground, the club, the blotched statue of Queen and Empress restored to its pedestal, a decorous few hundred yards where Europeans were walking to their work in the trading companies and government offices, the sun-dried men sometimes accompanied by pale, seemly wife or daughter in starched flowers or well-pressed pleats. At that hour, too, the tourists were coming ashore from the president lines, headed for tablecloths, carved ivory, and cloudy jade. A surge of early purpose seemed to be leading to something more than the chronic anticlimax of nightfall. The harbor was an old photograph, a resumption. Gray ships of war, shabby freighters, and the stout passenger ships with banded funnels. And the swarming sampans and lighters, the junks with tan sails boned like fans, and the tan-colored bony man at the stern working the ulo, the greater junks like galleons, and the coastal steamers off the Praia, arriving from Amoy and Swatow or from Green Saigon. The office was in the bank building, the best building, the white block formed like a cenotaph that had been pointed out to Exley at the time of his arrival. The highest building and the only one air-conditioned. The bank had thrown over the historic slow rotations of the ceiling fan in favor of the new climate, man-made. This building of 13 stories was, one was told, the tallest between San Francisco and Cairo. Exley, however, had a cubicle on a low floor in a set of rooms occupied by fellow officers. A group of translators in an inner room were local staff. There was an admiralty clerk on loan who did the legal drafting, and a naval messenger had a chair near the door. Three service women worked in a room next to Exley's own, none of them pretty, none really young. One of them, Miss Brenda Mills, showed signs of ill nature. Of the other two, Exley could not be sure which was Monica and which Nora, and left it too long to ask. All three lived at the Helena May Hostel above the town. Each had been taken out in turn by the British officers on the floor, who had nothing favorable to report. One other woman in the office was Eurasian of Portuguese descent. This was a typist, Miss Rita Xavier. There were also two Cantonese amas who brought tea thickened with condensed milk, cleaned the rooms, and in their tiny antechamber laughed with gold teeth at the pigeon jokes of the admiralty clerk, who puffed his pipe at them in passing. Here, through mornings and long afternoons, Peter Exley explored a heap of files and despaired of justice. His office had access to a terrace paved in big red tiles, undulated by the rains. The terrace, rarely used, looked towards the harbor. Seagulls wheeled there, and a cormorant at times alighted. On fair days, Exley would go out and lean a while on the wide ledge, would look at the war memorial with its patch of lawn and at the parked cars and the parked palm trees and the sea beyond. The heat soon drove him indoors. Even so, he got a name for mooning. That first summer in the steaming evenings, he would leave the barracks and walk east or west until the long streets came entirely, incontrovertibly, Chinese. He would stroll past the 100,000 stalls and tiny shops of food, of clothes, of soap and pots and bamboo baskets, past the minuscule dens hung with lanterns and braying out harsh music, where the soft smell of opium exuded into fumes of the street. From what would once have enthralled him, he would bring away only a flare of alien color and raucous sound, a stench of crowds and cooking, and that scent, sickly as boredom. Having walked in this way for an hour or two, he would then return by some divergent route, perhaps along the docks, ignoring peals from vendors or beggars and the offers from women whose negligible bodies seemed weighted with gold teeth and platform shoes. It was difficult to invest those meager frames with sensuality or to covet the lean shanks displayed by the flowered dress slit to the thigh. In these districts, Roy Rysom claimed to have cut his swath almost nightly, yet at the end of his own excursions, Exley would often discover Rysom having dinner tamely enough, tame hardly describing Rysom's way with chopsticks, at the King Fu on DeVoe Road, where a scattering of officers was always to be found. Sometimes Exley sat back with Rysom's group, giving himself over to the uproar of loud companions, the clamor of Chinese diners and of waiters yelling to the kitchen. From the gallery above, there was the incessant clack and crash of the mahjong pieces, the spitting and shouting of the players. His fellow soldiers repeated the stale anecdotes of lonely men. If anyone told a joke against himself, Rysom laughed too loud. His need for advantage, vigilant as fear. If they walked back together to the barracks, Rysom would caution Exley against his expeditions in the Chinese town. Filth. Filth was, in fact, on Peter Exley's mind in those first weeks, the accretion filming the Orient, the shimmer of sweat or excrement. A railing or handle one's fingers would not willingly grasp. Walls and objects grimed with existence. The limp, soiled colonial money. Little notes curled and withered like shavings from some discolored central load. Ammoniac reek or worse in paved alleys and under stuccoed arcades. Shaved heads of children blotched with sores. Gray palls of infants lolling from the swag that bound them to the mother's back, and the great clots and blobs of tubercular spittle shot with blood, unavoidable underfoot, what Rysom called poached eggs. In such uncleanness, nothing could appear innocent, not the infants themselves or even diseased chow dogs roaming the Chinese streets or scrawny chickens pecking at street dirt. What had not harrowed Exley as a soldier in Egypt or South Italy now brought revulsion. He longed for a measure of cleanliness with which he had somehow associated peace. Returning to the barracks with Rysom, he said, "I realize now that I came out here to be well fed and housed and have people wait on me. I see now that was in my mind." Rysom kicked open the door to the room. "Well, this is it, mate. The life of luxury." The greater thing was heat. In North Africa, the sun had been neutral, an impartial horror of war. Now, with the sensation of hostilities, heat came out in its true colors as the enemy. The privileged of the colony clung to the mountainside. The rest took refuge in any merciful shadow or flutter of the humid air. The town never cooled. Streets and street stalls brawled all night in the glare of naked electricity or paraffin lamps. A dry skin was an ultimate luxury, even for the privileged, even on a soft white body. Lust, if there was energy for it, must be consummated in a lather of sweat. And it was the same thing, no doubt, with love.
I have to recommend to the audience this wonderful interview that you did for the Paris Review. I have to recommend to the audience this wonderful interview that you did with the Paris Review with Sandy McClatchy. It's a terrific interview, thorough, and gave you all the time that you need, unlike tonight. But I have to question that Sandy and you talked about. And you said that you'd written novels before you wrote The Transit of Venus. They were shorter novels, these two, The Evening of the Holiday and The Bay of Noon and another. And then you had to sort of muscle up to a big book for The Transit of Venus. You didn't say muscle up. I said that. But I wonder if when a writer does that, in you in this case, do you feel like you're making yourself better when you do that? Do you feel like that when you're undertaking a much larger project than you had undertaken up to then, do you think to yourself, I'm going to have to be better?
I think this is so interesting because in the beginning when I began to write, it was a story, a short story, and what I had the feeling to write. And I remember that William Maxwell, who was my person at The New Yorker, who took my work marvelously, we used to talk about this, and he said once, I said, people are always, well, not always, but sometimes saying to me, well, obviously you'll write a novel. And it didn't seem so very obvious to me because I loved writing these short stories. But then there was a collection of the short stories. Knopf kindly asked to publish it. And I realized that the publisher has expectations that I'm going to come up with the great American novel or whatever it is. And I didn't, not in any of this did I feel, well, I won't be anybody until I have a big novel or something. I didn't feel this at all because I loved writing short stories. But somehow, yes, it grew on you, and not just from people's expectations, but you realized, yes, I have something more to say. But it didn't seem to me essential because there have been writers I admire very much who never wrote a novel. They wrote short stories, wonderful short stories. So I didn't feel particularly guilty about this. But yes, I realized that I would like to write it more at length and have a better chance to develop the characters that I was depicting.
And a chance to use more words.
Well, I must tell you that it sounds so much better when Annabelle is so eloquent because this is true of many writers, though not of all, I very rarely reread what's been published.
Oh.
And so this is very pleasant for me. I hear this beautiful
not
rendering.
Not so bad.
You know, this beautiful rendering of something I didn't even remember I wrote, but I'm very happy.
You've said that you routinely have to goad yourself to write. What's the resistance? What are you goading yourself against?
You're goading yourself against not being able to express what you feel you have in you.
It's not something you'd rather be
doing. I think a lot of life is like that.
It's not that you're goading yourself against something you'd rather be doing.
No. I remember what I used to do before when I worked at the United Nations. Nothing doing.
I'm curious to know, you've, in almost everything that you say in public, you talk so much about your life as a reader. And I'm wondering if you feel this life in literature, this life in books, has caused you to miss anything in your life that you wish that you hadn't missed.
I don't think it's quite the sense of missing. You probably are right that there's something there, but I never regarded it that way. I felt that one is able to have, without the suffering the great pain of it, one's able to have another life in this expressing what one has learned from observation. You don't have to go through everything yourself, though some writers do draw completely on their lives. Some writers of fiction draw very much on their own life. And it's inevitable one would do this, especially at the beginning. But then it doesn't go on always quite like that. But you do observe, people think you observe closely, perhaps this is true of some writers, that you observe very closely, more closely than people do ordinarily in life. And that may be true, but I think one observes more selectively. You realize you can't be spilling out a fascinated interest in everything and retain imagination, because you have to add something that you've learned from experience yourself has to infect or has to illuminate whatever you are doing. Mm. And also, there are still people who write, as was in the past, in the 19th century, marvelous writers who wrote from imagination, although they also drew on their own lives, especially when they had had very deprived and difficult lives. But it's observation that goes into a writer's life, I think, in a different way from the general the general absorption of things, because people generally have to get on with their lives. They can't stop and sit gawping into space at an empty table, but knowing that something will come that you can develop into a more general observation of life, perhaps.
I have to ask you a nuts and bolts question. What do you find the hardest thing to do in your job as a writer? Which is to say, in terms of the formal features of any piece of fiction, those formal features being structuring or making characters or writing dialogue, is there something that when you're at your desk and you come upon a moment when you know what you're going to have to do, you think to yourself, oh, gee, this is the thing I'm least good at?
Yes, I like writing dialogue.
You do.
And I like the sense of being able to say to a character, shut up, she explained, or something like that. And I like to have an open ear for speech, not only as a writer, but because it makes life so interesting to have characters in real life developing their eloquence, developing the expression of themselves. But I think I'm getting off your question.
Well, you eluded it, I will say that. The thing you don't like, is there something that you don't?
About writing?
Yes.
No.
Oh.
No. Well, writing checks or something, yes.
I'm sorry to keep bouncing from subject to subject, but I got a lot of subjects.
I like it.
Oh, good. Me too. Happily now, I think in America, literary theory has pretty well strangled itself to death in the universities. But I think you have said some rather interesting things about literary theory as a way of introducing young minds to literature. And I would love to hear you talk about it some more. You quoted Elizabeth Bowen as saying that, after all, novels are just supposed to be a part of life. And literature has been for the last 30 or 40 years taught in American universities in ways that make them not seem very much like a part of life.
I think the word criticism is not a very popular word with me. I don't mean adverse criticism, obviously.
No.
That would be unpopular. But I don't feel we need to be instructed all the time. And I think the more instruction there is, the less spontaneous acceptance there is. I think people have to be return to perhaps the expectation of reading for themselves and entering into literature in that way, that they live the characters. Of course, these have to be books that are really worth reading.
Mm.
But I don't mean heavy books or difficult books, but books that people always read that now get too much explication. Really, this explication, who was it said, where is the something we have lost in, where is the knowledge we have lost in information? And I would say, where is the information we lost in explication? Because we're going always towards something which is creeping away from the essence of art.
Mm. Mm.
And it's so delightful when you read a work of imagination and you live with those characters. And we've all done that with wonderful books, that you feel you don't want to put the light out and go to sleep, because what are they going to do while I'm asleep, you know? that aspect, much more spontaneous than it's become. And there was much wider reading in a certain sense in the 19th century. For one thing, there weren't all the gadgets and the telly and these things, but there was a compulsion to read, because it was the entertainment of the time also.
Mm. Well, we're coming near the end of our wonderful hour together, all of us. And I have been asked, perhaps unwisely, to read the beginning of The Transit of Venus.
Thank you.
Which you will get with a Mississippi accent, nothing like Annabelle's wonderful accent, which seems right for the words.
I hope it's good. I haven't read it for a long time.
Oh, it's good.
Thank you. Good.
This is a novel which won the Book Critics Circle Award. It was published in 1980. By nightfall, the headlines would be reporting devastation. It was simply that the sky on a shadeless day suddenly lowered itself like an awning. Purple silence petrified the limbs of trees and stood crops upright in the fields like hair on end. Whatever there was of fresh white paint sprang out of the downs or dunes or lacerated a roadside with a streak of fencing. This occurred shortly after midday on a summer Monday in the south of England. As late as the following morning, small paragraphs would even appear in newspapers having space to fill due to a hiatus in elections, fiendish crimes in the Korean War, unroofed houses and stripped orchards being given in numbers and acreage, with only lastly, briefly, the mention of a body where a bridge was swept away. That noon, a man was walking slowly into a landscape under a branch of lightning. A frame of almost human expectancy defined this scene, which he entered from the left-hand corner. Every nerve for even barns and wheelbarrows and things without tissue developed nerve in those moments, waited, fatalistic. Only he, kinetic, advanced against circumstances to a single destination. Farmers moved methodically, leading animals or propelling machines to shelter. Beyond the horizon, provincial streets went frantic at the first drops. Wipers wagged on windshields, and people also charged and dodged to and fro, to and fro. Packages were bunged inside coat fronts, newspapers upturned on new perms. A dog raced through a cathedral. Children ran in thrilling from playgrounds. Windows thudded, doors slammed. Housewives were rushing and crying out, "My washing." And a sudden stripe of light split earth from sky.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure.
Thank you.